Even now, I am still in search of a work which exercises such a dangerous fascination, such a spine-tingling and blissful infinity as Tristan. I have sought in vain in every art. That was the 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche responding to Richard Wagner's opera, the ancient Tristan and Isolde myth. What is this music, then, that can create these infinities and exert such a dangerous fascination? Where did it come from? And what makes it special? To reckon with the Western musical tradition from its origins in the medieval mind and its evolution over centuries in new forms, new instruments and new traditions, an inexhaustible complexity of music, talent and imagination, I'm joined by Richard Bratby, the chief classical music critic of The Spectator, and Alexandra Wilson, musicologist and cultural historian. Alex, where does it all begin? Why are we sitting here now debating what this tradition means?
Goodness, what a big question. Well, I mean, the history of music, it goes back to ancient times. I mean, there's been music since the ancient Greeks and Romans. But I mean, I suppose we talk about the Western musical tradition starting in medieval times with church music centred around Notre Dame, for example, in Paris. Also the troubadours and the trouvères. So you have the sacred and the secular right there from the start. And then it develops in many, many different contexts over the centuries since. So much to take in.
Mm. Richard?
I mean, I think the church certainly has to be acknowledged. I think the Christian church, underpinning centre point of European culture, I mean, it has played a big role in it as an early patron, as an early source of music. I mean, there's always this tension as well, wasn't there, between this idea that music is meant to be anonymous, is meant to be serving God, serving the word, the texts of the Bible, serving liturgy, and this idea of actual creativity. And that's a sort of tension that's gone on really throughout the history of Western music. And perhaps many of us would date the history of Western music from Hildegard of Bingen, who I think was around the 12th century, am I right? I'm trying to remember the dates here. But the first named composer, I think she would not have wanted to have been named. She would have expected the music simply to be used as to serve God. And but yet, there's that individuality, this discovery, this kind of thing can convey emotional expression, it can convey meaning, it can entertain, of course, so it's always that going on in parallel with church music. But I think from these two things, a classical tradition started to emerge, this idea of individual composers creating something which could entertain, something which could certainly serve a practical function like in the church, but perhaps can do both, perhaps can sort of transcend those purposes and become something meaningful in its own right.
I think there are three things, aren't there? There's music that's functional, there's music that's purely entertaining, and there's music that's art. And those boundaries are sometimes
quite hazy. That's a vexed question, isn't it, really? But it's certainly, yes, that's one I'm looking at, I think.
But early on, there's quite a close relationship between the words and the music in that kind of really early church music in the 12th century. What does Hildegard do differently from, say, just the music matching each vowel in succession?
Well, I think it's, again, somehow, I mean, we're talking really about just what we call melodies, simple melodies here, almost no harmony as we understand it, not much sense of rhythmic movement even beyond what's dictated by the words and the meaning of the words. And somehow this remarkable woman back then, practically just emerging from the Dark Ages, is able to charge something as simple as a line of melody with a personality, with an expression, with an expressive power that transcends merely illustrating the words, merely giving you something to sort of chant in church. It's your sort of first sense of a personality of a creator, an individual creator, expressing themselves through music. And I think that's probably maybe the single most important thing that we think of as defining Western classical music, the idea of a composer, of someone who's creating, given shape to something in an attempt to create something. Yeah, it's bigger than the sum of its parts.
So it's sort of nourished in monasteries and in devotional life. When do we start getting more secular music intruding and more personalities involved? And I think in the UK, you probably think of the first really famous composers, Thomas Tallis. You know, what explains someone like him compared to what came before?
Well, I mean, with Tallis, we're still talking about a lot of sacred music.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, if we look over, for example, to Italy and think about Monteverdi, there's someone who's writing sacred music, but who's also branching out into opera. The very earliest beginnings of opera around the year 1600. And that begins as a form of courtly entertainment for aristocrats, you know, dukes and princes trying to outdo their rivals with the more extravagant, spectacular theatrical works for weddings and so on. But within only a few decades, it becomes a commercial form of entertainment. Okay. Impresarios see an opportunity, particularly in Venice, to open theatres and to put these new works on. It's literally bums on seats from even those very early times.
I think there's something to be said also about the growth of civic society, the growth of sort of stable European, certainly not democracies at this stage, but societies in which classes beyond the elite can thrive, can flourish, can have a cultural life. And you see with some of these earlier composers, Monteverdi, who was very much a man of his time, who worked in the church, was patronised by great noblemen, similarly with Tallis, similarly with Byrd. But equally, these people were doing things on the side. They're writing music for entertainment, starting to write beautifully crafted music to amuse and entertain, perhaps people at the upper end of society, but certainly music has expanded far beyond the merely functional, far beyond the purpose of glorifying state or helping church services. So, I mean, the madrigals of Monteverdi are as glorious as anything he wrote, I think it's safe to say. And in England, we have this remarkable Tudor flowering of composers, Dowland, Byrd, Orlando Gibbons, these people who wrote not only extraordinary sacred music, but also managed to write music purely for entertainment, music purely for the joy of expression, for civilised people and not necessarily particularly civilised people, to sing in pubs or to sing in their houses or to sing, you know, just for their own entertainment.
How does the Reformation change assumptions about, you know, music? I mean, Byrd and Tallis are quite interesting because they're both, I mean, Byrd in particular is a recusant Catholic, kind of grappling with that. And Tallis composes some incredible music that's very much in the kind of traditional European Catholic world, but also some music which reflects the growing culture of the words, the use of English in devotional music. I'm trying to get to the bottom of that just simply because to illustrate how society changes music and how music changes society.
Well, I think to reduce it down to purely pragmatic matters, that period really illustrates the importance of questions of patronage and the fact that musicians back then were essentially servants. They were paid to do something and they were going to do that. So you see that very clearly with those composers who were living at that time and in quite elevated court positions and were having to change the style of music that they wrote quite radically according to who was on the throne at any given moment in that time of great flux.
I mean, Byrd is a fascinating case, isn't it? Because he was clearly very close to the court of Elizabeth I. It's a time of great religious divides, as we know. And he was also equally clearly a practicing Catholic in his private life. And it seems very clear the Queen was aware of this, the court were aware of this, and because of his gifts, because he was discreet, because he was an individual with such rare talent and value to the court. He was sort of excused, a blind eye was turned, exceptions were made. It wasn't as absolute as it seemed. Yeah. And then I think with the Reformation, I mean, I suppose the big idea in the Reformation is the idea of the emergence of the individual conscience, the individual taste, the value of individual choice, perhaps, in religious as well as secular life. And I suppose that opens up the possibility of enjoyment, of leisure, of music as something to enrich our lives outside of having a purely spiritual, pragmatic purpose. It's not just about showing allegiance to the monarch, to the nobleman, to the duke, or about showing yourself to be suitably pious. It's something that it sort of breaks the bounds of those traditional, gradually at first, but with increasing power, but it certainly breaks the bounds of its traditional categories, I think, and starts to really spread out into a much wider part of society. You see that in England with Purcell, who was at one point writing grand ceremonial music for the Stuart and later Orange Court, at the same time writing madrigals, writing ditties, writing some things that have quite rude words, and selling them on the open markets in London, and writing things for the theatre, putting on these what we now call effectively musicals in the West End of the day, and clearly doing very well out of it.
Yeah, so there's a sort of growing market for music. How did a figure like J.S. Bach emerge, and what did he change about the history of music when he came on the scene? We're sort of fast-forwarding quickly through the decades and centuries. But how does Bach come into the kind of European world and reshape it?
Well, I mean, Bach was a jobbing church musician as well. I mean, he was producing what was required of him, but it is astonishing that within that context, he managed to produce works that were of such sublime quality. I mean, we musicologists these days tend to shy away from using words like great or genius. It's sort of all fallen out of fashion, but I think we might be allowed to use those words here. There is some transcendental quality to his music that has endured.
But equally, I don't know if I actually agree, but I mean, saying that Bach changed the course of music is slightly misleading, because he was, as she says, just a jobbing church musician. Yeah. In his time, he's perhaps seen almost as a rather old-fashioned one, very learned one, very skilled one, one who's admired by professionals, but not perhaps particularly popular one, and certainly one who didn't have much impact in his lifetime outside of North Germany. It's obvious that the next generation of composers are more impressed by people like Handel, by people like Corelli and Vivaldi, and Bach actually rather fell into disuse nearly a century afterwards.
Yeah, it had to be sort of rediscovered. Yeah.
So in a sense, he didn't really influence much in his time. His influence has been largely posthumous. I mean, he's had a big influence on 19th and 20th century music, and of course is now recognised for just being something almost stands out of time for his sheer, scale of what he did. But I don't think that was widely perceived at the time. Yeah. There's a brilliant, I don't know if you know Patrick O'Brien's seafaring novels about these two music-loving chaps sailing on 18th century sailing vessels. And at one point they're having they're wonderfully written books. One of the characters says, well, we've been playing all this music by C.P. Bach, by Bach, as they call him, Bach's oldest son, far better known in his time. Mm. And one says, well, did you realise? Turns out that Bach had a father. So I believe that was quite normal, says the other character. And of course, they dug out some music by J.S. Bach, which is a little anachronism.
So, I guess it shows how much this stuff is reconstructed after the moment. And it's especially true of just even the phrase classical music, which we use as a byword for a certain kind of tradition. But the actual classical period, if we're going to use it in a more specific sense, is from around the 1750s to around 1820.
And yet those labels weren't used at the time.
Exactly,
what era would we say we are in now? Somebody in the future is going to call this period
the age of catastrophe.
It's possibly.
End times.
But certainly, there's huge debate about when the dates you would put on the Romantic era. Yeah. Some people would confine it to the very beginning of the 19th century, 1830s, 1840s. Sometimes it's used for the whole of the 19th century. Sometimes it's stretching beyond. So these labels, people weren't aware of them at the time.
But so let's pick out the three composers we normally associate, the most famous, Joseph Haydn, Mozart and Beethoven. Is it fair to describe Haydn as a great innovator who did change the course of music?
I would absolutely say so. I mean, he really was. He was well known and famous in his lifetime, admired for what he did in his lifetime, known to be influential. Beethoven studied with him. Mozart was a close friend. And actually, we know he sat down with Haydn's scores and studied sort of innovations and techniques that Haydn brought in his string quartets before setting out to introduce them to his own language. So he's clearly seen as someone who was changing the language of music and had something special and different to say. Perhaps the first composer, maybe except after Handel, who was widely acknowledged as doing that, as being of interest to people outside his immediate sphere and having a worth that might last beyond his lifetime.
But was he he's still part of those networks of patronage and courtly life?
Absolutely. I mean, he was there's a fantastic document surviving from the... he's employed for many years by the court of the Esterházy princes in Hungary, who colossal landowners, gigantic palatial mansions, the prince's estate. He had an opera house. He had a second opera house just for use of marionettes. He had a brewery. He had all these things, this colossal mansion, whole villages built as houses of servants. And Haydn, it said, was required to turn up every Monday morning in livery with his hair neatly tied. This is all specified in the contract where he will take his instructions from the prince and during the course of the week will carry out those instructions. And that was quite understood. And Haydn considered himself extremely lucky to have those conditions. That was what most musicians of that period aspired to, a solid job, solid income, all the resources that you need at your disposal, a full orchestra, theatres, a patron who appreciated what you could do. I mean, that was really the ideal for an 18th century composer. And the fact that you were technically a servant surprised no one. I think modern ideas of equality were not widespread. I think it was there was a divine order in the universe. You had your place. Your role was to do your best in that place. And I think Haydn, a very religious man, he knew his own worth, and he has certainly not without personal pride in what he did. But he was happy to work in those conditions.
And he's known as the kind of father of the symphony and the string quartet. What were the kind of material things that helped him to compose music for that? Were there innovations in the technologies? Were there standards to violins? What were the technological changes that allowed you to say, I'm going to compose a symphony or a string quartet and I could compose that for a market which went beyond just the people I know or the town I live in? This could be diffused across cities and across a continent.
I mean, there's publishing, wasn't there? Publishing really been expanding
really
since the 17th century. And it's amazing how quickly stuff got around Europe. I mean, the composer working in Newcastle upon Tyne in England, then just a coal town, basically, who was in possession of the complete concertos for string orchestra by Corelli from Rome within months of them being published and was making his own versions of them. So it really did get around. It was not as, we don't have to have the internet sort of transmit this stuff. It got about. But then, instruments, as you say. I mean, I think in the Baroque era, Bach and so on, are still almost a legacy of the Renaissance. We're still working with assumptions about how music has to be written and could be written based in the instruments of a previous generation. By the late 18th century, the violin family has emerged from Northern Italy. These very versatile, very brilliant, very playable instruments, great power as well as great delicacy. And I think the power is the thing, really, though, the fact that they can really project a lot of sound, very versatile. And they've really come into their own. These things are being made in large numbers, are being played in large numbers, always becoming standardised. and courts across Europe are kind of standardising and copying each other. They're sort of building these little ensembles. You have a group of string players, maybe a couple of wind players. If you've got some soldiers nearby, you can bring in some horns and trumpets and drums for special occasions. There is also the fact that Germany at this time is divided, and Italy for that matter, divided into lots and lots of competing little states and principalities, and every one of them has this sort of strutting Grand Duke and his little court, who has to have his little orchestra to show it, and his little opera house to show that he can compete with the rest. So it was a great fertility and a great opportunity for musicians, a huge potential market, and a huge spread of these ideas and ensembles.
I guess the life of someone like Mozart shows that, you know, how he becomes famous and his story is really interesting that way. What do you think, Alex?
Well, I mean, Mozart, his life is really the flip side to Haydn's, isn't it, in terms of failing to get that patronage and to have that stable position that would have allowed him to, well, who knows? I mean, he died so young. Who knows what would have happened, whether he might have had greater success. But yes, I mean, by the time we move into the 19th century, composers are starting to put together what we might now call a portfolio career. So that we've got the decline of that sort of court musician position. And yeah, publishing music, teaching music, writing commissions for perhaps a broader range of clients. But Mozart comes just too early for that. And again, his music might well have fallen into obscurity, but it somehow just manages to hold on there in the consciousness.
He sort of tried to have a freelance career and didn't quite bring it off. Though he's kind of ahead of his time in some ways, I think. And maybe he'd have done better if he'd lived another couple of decades, but that was it.
And then we get to Beethoven, and I guess he's a bit later as well. So he's now in a period where there are things like the cult of the artist, and there's this strong sense of individuals making art for particular reasons. How does he change?
Well, the key thing there in terms of music broadly is the emergence of what we would call the work concept. Right. Up to that point, we think of music history as being, we talk about the event-centred musical culture, which is to say that pieces of music were written for special occasions, for particular occasions, and then often abandoned.
Yeah.
That was it. There was no sense of a repertoire that pieces would be performed over and over, just wasn't a thing. But that starts to change in the early 19th century, and Beethoven's just on the cusp of that, really. And it's bound up with changes in concert culture, but it's also bound up with the emergence of copyright, I think, the idea that music belongs to that composer. And in previous times, composers had been pretty free and easy with recycling their music. So, you know, they had to churn it out in such quantities that they literally had to reuse bits. Okay. You do still see that in the early 19th century. For example, I mean, somebody like Donizetti, who wrote so many operas, was just lifting bits and reusing them. And that was fine. It was his music. But over the course of the 19th century, that starts to become no longer the dumb thing. Audiences want to hear something new from you each time.
And do you think there's a lot of personal competitiveness as well that grows up, that people know each other, they go and visit each other, they start mythologizing each other too, and there's kind of the personality starts to conflict as well?
Certainly the cult of personality is a big thing in the early 19th century. I mean, we think of those kind of showman musicians like Chopin or Paganini and so on. Certainly the cult of personality, I suppose that's bound up with the rise of print media, no doubt, with magazines writing about these people or newspapers.
I mean, it's a more democratic age as well, isn't it? So there is this sort of a recognisable, almost modern celebrity culture. There's fashions, there's fads, there's trends. And some of these composers are in quite distinctive waves. I mean, in France, you have these old guard, people like Cherubini, whose names we don't really know anymore, who guardians of the old-fashioned formal way of doing things. Then you have these bright young stars, these sort of rock stars of the age, sort of Hector Berlioz, who's dangerous, who challenges the establishment, who's difficult, doesn't fit in, breaks the rules. And he's being championed by a network of similar composers across Europe, people like Schumann, great German critic as well as composer, who kind of saw it as his mission to kind of see these kind of young romantics sort of make them almost into a cause to sort of promote them. And he pushed the music of Schubert, he pushed the music of Weber, he pushed the music of Liszt, the music of Berlioz, the music of Wagner when he was early in his career. All of them, you know, it's this sort of idea that we are, our generation sticks together, this is a new wave. We're sort of doing things differently, and we're sticking up for each other, and we're all in this sort of imaginary band of brothers, if you like. And if you were of that generation, you'd go for that kind of music. And it's almost recognising like modern celebrity or pop culture, I think, in the way some of these people caught on. And you know, the excitement, the flamboyance of a performer like Liszt or Paganini, the great violinist, who show up, do unimaginable feats of sort of virtuosity on his violin, leave everyone reeling, people fainting in the audience, and then drive on to the next town in a shower of gold. It's a recognisable celebrity culture.
Is there then a kind of darker thing that happens with the end of the 19th century and the kind of first half of the 20th century, that music starts getting churned into European countries catching up? You know, thinking of the outbreak of the First World War, many Austria-Hungarian composers were keen to go to the front and were very patriotic. And then how does mass conflict shape this tradition in new directions? Because a lot of the composers, I mean, Ravel has, his life is bound up with the First World War. Yeah, how does war and that kind of that new age shape classical music?
Very varied, I would say. Yeah. I mean, thinking about my composer, who I've written about a lot, Puccini, he was very keen to keep out of things in the First World War.
Yeah,
I mean, he wasn't fighting, he was too old for that. But he was someone who wanted to keep all his income streams, let's say.
Okay.
So he didn't want to alienate the Austrians, for example. And he was all for going forward and writing a quasi-Viennese operetta, which eventually became La Rondine. But in fact, enough is enough, people said, it had to be performed in Monte Carlo.
Because Italy started out as an ally of Austria in the First World War and then switched sides halfway through, so it should rather left him high and dry.
But there was also a petition about the war. I can't remember exactly what the details were about it, whether it was about Italy entering the war or something. And Puccini didn't want to sign it, and he got a lot of flack for that. But, he didn't want to get involved. But
again, they were people of their time and people of a time that, and for the last half century, nationalism being seen as a great progressive force in European. The idea of all these small countries with small cultures finding their voices, rejoicing in folk culture, finding their national identities, reviving their languages, was seen as that was a very much the liberal, educated, progressive, forward-looking thing to do.
Yeah.
Also, again, patriotism was not really widely questioned. People talk high ideals during peacetime, but when the war was declared, when 1914 happened, everyone quickly makes it very clear they're on the right side. They all rally to the colours, by and large. It's quite unexpected to people. We like to assume that modernists like Schoenberg, like Berg, like Webern, were these sort of progressive intellectuals who were far above this squalid nationalism. In fact, they're enthusiastically signing up, getting to the front. Schoenberg wrote a tub-thumping military march for his regiment. He issued some very intemperate statements about the inferiority of non-German musical cultures. And these are people he'd been, you know, dealing with, admiring, working with, very happily before the war. So, I mean, they're people. They're people of their time, and they're working in the context of their time. And in terms of the way it shaped the music itself, I mean, I think there was this sort of, in a sense, the First World War marked the end of Romanticism in some ways, because it seemed to be, looking back with hindsight, it all looked terribly compromised, that whole culture, that whole world that has provided the the breeding ground for the war, for the conflict. It seemed very tied up with the music and the art of that period, as unfashionable art always does. You know, it does seem very dated, right? It does seem very culpable in the sins of the previous generation. And, you know, we see that even now. And I think certainly there's a big reaction against the kind of music you're seeing before the First World War, after the First World War. This all turned towards dissonance, towards clarity, towards smaller ensembles, towards a reaction against the great romantic tradition of Wagner, Richard Strauss and Mahler and Elgar and Rachmaninoff and all these people. Yeah.
A change sort of explored very eloquently by Thomas Mann in his novel Dr. Faustus, which is about a modernist composer who makes a deal with the devil. But there's a very interesting series of discussions in the opening stages of the novel. Adrian Leverkuhn is the main character. He's a German musician, composer, and with his friends before the First World War, they talk about what German unification means for music and what music can do in terms of creating a new man, creating a new kind of society. That novel feels very interesting because it feels like classical music nowadays is not bound up in quite the same way with arguments that are so sort of vivid and thrilling, especially not in Germany, where classical music is like a safe space outside of politics. It's like, you know, a kind of nice place where we can be proud of.
I think that they worked very, very hard to redefine classical music in that sense in Germany after the Second World War. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, it's very far from clear, I think, after the Second World War that it was quite so innocent of blame, really, if you like, for what happened. I mean, and you know, the denazification of Bayreuth, the reinvention of Wagner staging from you know, literal productions of people with horned helmets and spears to the almost universal modern trend now, which is to debunk, to question, to satirise, to sort of strip away these romantic trappings. That's definitely a product of that. But yes, it's...
Well, I think that's a pretty good summary of the whole history of the Western musical holes. Tradition. But
other versions are available.
I'd like now to turn to the present, and I guess several questions here. What we call classical music, or whatever we want to call it, in the West at any rate, is there's plenty of competition for people's attention. There's other genres of music, there's film, there's the internet, TV. If we accept that there is a kind of crisis in classical music, or you know, that kind of narrative that you know people are turning off where they might have tuned in, what are the roots of that crisis? If we accept that, if we don't, what you know?
There are many and various.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, there's the decline of music education, which has been going on these last few decades. So people are simply not encountering classical music as children. And so that seed of enthusiasm is not being sown. So that's governments to blame for that, essentially. But there's more to it than that. There are also big attitudinal shifts towards classical music. And this is something that I've worked on a lot, this wretched elitism stereotype that's been pinned on classical music. And I've researched the roots of that stereotype. And although it's very complicated, and there are many different strands to it, I'm looking at it with regard to opera specifically. But it's quite a new phenomenon in the form we know it now, so sort of 1980s onwards. And it became almost like just a mantra of the media.
Is it just a peculiarly British phenomenon?
Well, I've only looked at the British phenomenon because I think each country has its own cultural history that's quite distinct, so it's impossible to make generalisations. The elitism stereotype is even stronger in America, but for different reasons. That comes from a different root. And now these two attitudes are sort of mingling in the internet age. Mm. But from the 80s, 90s, about 2000 onwards, particularly, this stereotype becomes the sort of just default way of thinking in the media. So you get to a point where any singer or director or whatever composer who would be interviewed in the media would be asked straight away, and what are you going to do about the elitism of opera? Mm. Isn't this all for posh people? Isn't this all terribly expensive? Now, the problem is that this is several generations on now. It's just become received wisdom. And what's worse is that these attitudes are even, I think, becoming something that you'll find shared among people who actually work in classical music now, whether they're, not everyone, of course, but some, whether they're in the practical business of music making or if they're in arts education. There's a sort of apologetic tone that surrounds classical music now. And it's become yet worse. Now there are these narratives around decolonisation and around breaking down the canon. The canon is now seen as, the canon is a very nebulous thing, but it's seen as an oppressive thing and bound up with historic power structures and so on. And all of this is really bad press for classical music. Classical music is, as I say, it's almost having to apologise for itself. So there's plenty of problems there.
Richard?
I mean, I just have certainly a double standard at play in the way that the mass media presents classical music. I mean, as we know, performers of popular music who are delivering the most aggressively misogynistic and racist lyrics are lionized as heroes of our time. Classical music is the one that has to apologize for the fact that a composer 150 years ago might have used the wrong pronouns. I don't know. I mean, it's possible, I think, to be too pessimistic. I think... I'm always being told about the death of CD recording, yet CDs keep rattling. This obsolete medium keep rattling through my letterbox. I've got a pile so big I don't know what to do with them. And things I can't do, I don't have time to listen to the numbers that are being produced. I ran a youth orchestra in Birmingham for many years, aimed at quite a high end, quite a high level. These are people from 14 to 21 playing at almost professional standard, young musicians. And they weren't by no means all privately educated. Many of them came from Birmingham's whole range of communities. And what I noticed was we had 100 places in the orchestra every year, and every single year we were turning 300 young people away because they were so desperately keen to play this music. And when they got into this orchestra, having, by whatever means, through their schools, through their parents funding them, through having opportunities that were perhaps denied to others, and some of them simply seeing the opportunities on offer and taking them, they would be absolutely determined to engage with the music. They did not want to play film music. They did not want to play transcriptions of pop songs. They wanted to play Shostakovich. They wanted to play Mahler. They wanted to play Messiaen. And they absolutely threw themselves at it. And I saw that over and over again, the enthusiasm, the light in their eyes. And I think that's still the case. I mean, they don't necessarily turn into concert goers, of course. That's a different thing, because I think younger generations are more inclined to do than to act. I think we're sitting down and listening is perhaps has always been more a pursuit of the older, the wealthier, the more leisured, the more easily exhausted.
But this is a problem at the moment, yeah. That we seem to live in an age where there's more rather than less stereotyping, pigeonholing and so on. That not only applies to the classical music itself, but it applies to people and to tastes. So we're constantly told that the only way to engage the young through music is via pop music and via popular music of certain types, rap and so on. You remember when they were going to put... There was lots of talk about how young people could be engaged through Stormzy, not Mozart, you know, this sort of thing. But what you've said shows that that's not true. That, you know, there's so much generalisation now about what young people like, what older people like. But there are young people out there who love this stuff, if only they're given the opportunity to encounter it.
There's an interesting contrast that just springs to mind here of what role classical music played in the middle of the last century. The kind of proletarian arts music of Aaron Copland, the kind of moment of Shostakovich with the Leningrad Symphony, which was used as a kind of propaganda tool to show a kind of common link between the American worker, the Soviet worker, the people's war against Hitler. And classical music was all part of that. The interesting thing about Copland and his generation is that the kinds of musical forms he championed were taken up by people in the kind of rock world. There is a link to people like Bob Dylan in the way they re-engineered folk music and made it into a kind of national form. So I always think with classical music, whenever you actually dig into it, to any single composer in the kind of classical tradition, the links start emerging all over the place to pop, rock, jazz, genres which don't need to argue for their status, really. But that pigeonholing is very counterproductive because we start siphoning off things which really are just deeply interconnected and influence each other.
I mean, there is a structural problem, it's true. Pop, jazz, all these things you're talking about, certainly pop, certainly rock, the commercial genres. Well, they're commercial genres. They don't need public money. They don't need funding. They don't need backing up. There is this structural problem with classical music. It goes back to the Renaissance, really, where we started, is that it's designed as an art form. It assumes that someone somewhere is pumping a lot of money into it. All its great works, all its structures designed on the assumption that someone somewhere thinks this is worth paying for. Mm. You can't, honestly, and I mean, God knows I did it for 16 years, try and run a symphony orchestra with a staff of 80 musicians playing serious repertoire for 40 weeks a year, selling seats at affordable prices to audiences no more than 2,000, and possibly hope to break even, let alone turn a profit. So it does rely on someone somewhere pumping in money they're not going to get back because they believe that what comes out at the other end is so intrinsically valuable and life-enhancing. And that is a problem, making that case, especially in an era such as, a time such as we live now, where, you know, why should the masses pay for the tastes of the elites? This is where that argument becomes so poisonous. Mm. The idea that it's a shared possession, that it's available to everyone, which is the original idea behind art subsidy in the modern world, has been rather lost. I mean, that was the idea, as I understand it, of the post-war consensus, certainly in Britain, that not that the elites want to keep preserving their special pleasures, but rather these pleasures should be available to everybody, in as far as they ever were to preserve the elites, which I know Alex would refute very, very authoritatively, and I think I would as well.
You're right, it becomes immediately sectarian.
It's about accessibility of the best that Western civilization, making the best of what Western civilization has produced, and that's not a value judgment against other forms of art which don't need that subsidy, but this is one particular part of the best of what Western civilization produced that does need subsidy if it's going to exist at all. You know, opera, symphonic music, chamber music perhaps less so, smaller scale, so obviously anyone can play a piano, but the money is unfortunately baked in and is essential, and that's what's at threat.
It's very interesting. I would come back to the elitism point specifically in a moment, but it's interesting you say that, Richard, because, you know, I was looking at some stats of classical music uptake outside of Europe, and China's a really interesting example. In 2012, there were 36 million Chinese children studying the piano, which was six times the number of American children at the same time. I know it's a vastly higher population, but this is in the context of an economy which is far less developed than America, much more the middle class, far less access to the kind of just the instruments. And I think it's really interesting that in China, when classical music, it was shunned in the kind of Mao era, but by the 90s, it became kind of a status symbol among the Politburo, president of China from 1993 to 2003, Jiang Zemin. He often played the piano for foreign leaders. He conducted orchestras. Is the future of classical music actually outside of Europe, where it's not necessarily seen as elitist, it's just seen as another tradition which can tell us something about their lives or give a new dimension?
Possibly.
Just less self-conscious about it.
Certainly there are an awful lot of East Asian students wanting to come to British conservatoires. Yeah.
And famous musicians.
In famous musicians and in the opera world, there are growing numbers of East Asian opera stars.
It's amazing just how many fantastically good bel canto tenors seem to be emerging from Thailand and Korea at the moment. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, if you go see almost any Italian opera, you can quite possibly see a Korean tenor in the lead just absolutely singing gloriously.
But I do find it Italian depressing that we might think the focus of gravity, the shift, it's all shifting to other parts of the world, and that here we're giving up on it. I mean, that would be terrible. I just hate this sort of self-loathing that we have of even to utter the words Western civilization is becoming sort of unacceptable. It's depressing.
Maybe people outside who are less close to what we have see the value of what we have more clearly than we do. Yeah. I think that's reasonable.
Well, China's very interesting because there's also been some very interesting work done on classics, so learning Greek and Latin. Plato's really popular in Chinese universities. Classical, the European philosophers are studied intensively by China's political elite for lessons but also for intellectual investigation. So just to come back to that elitism point and the kind of global conversation in music, it shows that these things are, you can come from a completely different intellectual tradition, one that is massively sophisticated as a great civilizational state in a way, and still think that these Western traditions have something to tell you and have something to add. You're not just happy with what you've got. And I just think that elitism point is fascinating that way.
Mm. I mean, children don't come at these things with any hang-ups. For example, perhaps people from other cultures don't come at them with these baggage and the idea that it's all kind of associated with problematic social structures in the past. And we didn't used to think of it like that either. So I think we're just at an unfortunate moment where we're overthinking things, perhaps.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. I mean, I was there's been a lot of talk in the classical music world over the last 18 months of the Arts Council of England's apparent loathing of the art form of opera. It seems to have a serious psychological problem with the existence of art form. Basically, it does really seem they're grounded entirely in those stereotypes of elitism, these outdated stereotypes. And I thought it was fascinating that this report was suggesting that opera should be thinking differently about the stories that are told, that they must be producing new work which is relevant to the issues that we say are relevant. And I went last year to visit, it was a touring opera promoter called Ellen Kent, who does these rather cheap and cheerful Eastern European opera companies. She brings over, puts on productions of standard classics at knockdown prices, and generally does pretty well with them. She makes money with them. She may be the only company in Britain that makes money by putting on opera. They do that by selling tickets for things people want to see, and what people want to see is not necessarily radical reworkings and not community operas about net zero. It is Madame Butterfly in oriental costume. It is Rigoletto done with, again, in the most traditional style imaginable, and people simply belting out the music. That is what people want to see and are actually paying to see, and is demonstrably paying its way. It was just, there does seem to be this disjoint between the sort of elite, I don't mean the elite we're talking about, just saying, you know, the sort of, if you like, the establishment, the sort of official
gatekeeping.
Yeah, so the people who hold the purse strings seem to have a particular idea of what we should be thinking, what we should be seeing, what we should be enjoying. And interestingly, whenever the audience is given a chance to demonstrate what they actually want to enjoy, turns out to be remarkably like traditional classical music.
And you mentioned the word relevance. This notion of relevance we have now is an absolute scourge, because relevance sounds great. Who wouldn't want things to be relevant? But someone is deciding what is relevant to whom.
Well, I did find it hilarious. I mean, they said something in this report about we need to look again at who's deciding whose stories are told. And I say, well, we must assume then that Covent Garden is staffed entirely by 19th century gypsies, 18th century Spanish philanderers, 19th century political prisoners of conscience, Sussex fishermen with emotional problems, etc.
But the impulse among people at the Arts Council and so on, this idea of relevance, is that everything must be related to us. It's very narcissistic. It's how everything must be related to our lives now. It's almost, it's infantilizing people. It's suggesting that people aren't capable of finding relevance to their lives in historic operas traditionally addressed.
Fascinatingly, I mean, you'll read whenever anyone writes an article about my hero Richard Wagner. I saw a Ring Cycle, whole Ring Cycle last week, and it's never time wasted. But and it's always, you know, there's always, we must get past these awful stereotypes of these sort of Germanic heroes in swords killing dragons, and what, this is all terribly, terribly embarrassing. We must make it about something else somehow, which you can do. That's a glorious thing about great art. It's subject to endless interpretations. But the argument is always, people can't relate to this stuff. We've grown up beyond this kind of nonsense now. Mm. And yet, one turns on the television, what's the most successful media franchise of this century is people in a medieval world killing dragons. And curiously enough, people seem quite capable of drawing quite far-ranging modern parallels, of seeing that speak to their lives, of finding inspiration, but also quite powerful, complex and challenging political lessons from watching these tales. And why that can be applied to The Lord of the Rings, it can be applied to Game of Thrones, it can be applied to Wolf Hall on the television. And it's sort of assumed that the silly little unwashed will not be able to handle this if presented in a 19th century opera. Mm. I find hard to understand.
Do you think it's just kind of interesting to contrast that conversation with, I mean, we did mention it, with the status of opera in Germany, which is still a great status symbol. Politicians go to Bayreuth to see Wagner, but then they often go to see these Regia Theater productions, which are incredibly vulgar, will tear down the music. And it's kind of a spectacle of the absurdity of the kind of German tradition that they all indulge in. But the music is still there, the kind of sublime music. But that seems to me understandable if you are a German person interested in your own high culture and the debates over reunification. It's interesting, one of the main characters in that movement to kind of take on the traditional opera was from East Germany, you know, talking about assumptions that the West German public had about art and trying to challenge that. That seems to me understandable in Germany, but in the UK, why is there this kind of constant culture of challenge and saying we have to reinterpret? Why is there that urgency to do that?
Well, I think you should be reinterpreting art. You should be looking in different ways and fresh ways and finding new stories to tell from it. Certainly, I mean, that's a valid approach. Mm. And equally, I'd say I don't think we have really swallowed the German stuff completely whole. We still, the sort of British directors, who interestingly are in great demand on the continent, many of them, people like Richard Jones or Nicholas Heitner or David Pountney, do have a more of a connection to the audience, more of a sense of actually communicating with an audience. I think we do have that tradition of a popular English language theatre in this country, which informs the way we approach art. And I think it's not as bad as you say. Because classical music operates in a kind of global economy, and the main engine house of that economy is Central Europe, really, certainly intellectually. It's true we end up importing and copying, and that style is very influential, even though it's often widely irrelevant to audiences here. But I don't want to be dogmatic about any one particular way of doing things. Mm. Clearly, Germans are working through their own issues, and who knows how long they'll be doing that. And it's, you know, it seems as if they can't see a piece of history without wanting to draw a moustache on it and to tear it down, to belittle it. And I can understand, we can all understand why that might be the case. But
we kind of talked about that a little bit earlier, about the kind of national variety of music and the way in which classical music was reinterpreted in national terms in the 19th century. It has a completely different status in Finland. You know, it has a different status in the kind of Russian world, as it were. I think that gets to the heart of the kind of intrinsic variety of the tradition and the malleability and flexibility of it. Yeah, just a statement. Well, you know, I think we've covered a huge amount of ground, but to round up, I'd like to have a sort of insight from both of you on some of the most important musical experiences you've had. You know, what are the kind of profound experiences this kind of world has to offer, and what are the most entertaining experiences you've had in music as well?
I'm very much a self-taught musician. My family weren't into classical music at all, so I kind of stumbled into it by chance. And I must say that one of the early influences for me was discovering music in film. I mean, there's nothing wrong with encountering classical music in that way. So, for example, A Room with a View, Puccini's music, absolutely sublime in that. I mean, that kind of set me on a road to becoming a Puccini scholar in a bizarre way. So that was one kind of starting point.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
The first opera I actually saw in the theatre was also Puccini. That was Tosca, but that didn't go quite so well because I didn't realise there were two intervals. There were no surtitles. Didn't know what was going on. No idea. Hadn't really been briefed in advance. Got my coat to go in the second interval. Anyway, so discovering music through classical music, through popular culture, through Gilbert and Sullivan was the route in for me. So I would never sniff at people coming to it from that kind of background. And then I loved orchestral music. I can remember sitting in a concert hearing the overture to Tannhäuser and just being blown away by that. I think there is something visceral and physical and sexy about this music. I mean, of course, there are many fantastic opera performances where there's a real star performer, and there's nothing like sitting there with 1,000 other people in silence in the dark and all, you know, hair on the back of your neck stands up. But I also have had wonderful experiences as a performer in choirs of experiencing the music from the inside out. And some of those have been the most magical experience for me of, again, being in a large group, particularly really large scale choral pieces. Yeah. Or sometimes if it's a piece you know particularly well and you can almost sing it without looking at the score at all, that's when it really takes flight and it's a truly magical experience.
Yeah, it's interesting you're talking about film because in the last few years, Hollywood's, there's been loads of films about classical music, Maestro, Tar and Maria Callas, among many others, you know, variable quality. But it does show that there is a lot of mileage in trying to portray these musical encounters on
screen. Classical music always makes headlines. Mm. I mean, look how many newspaper headlines it gets when something crazy or sensationalist happens in the music world. It's there's definitely interest in it.
Yeah. Richard?
Well, again, very similar to Alexander. I didn't come from a... My family were not musicians. My father had discovered music. I mean, he came from a sort of a lower middle-class family from the English provinces who once a year would go to hear The Messiah in Liverpool Philharmonic Hall. And my grandfather had a box of 78 RPM records, which he treasured, selected works that were played. My father followed that path himself, and with his first... Somehow, along the way, he'd heard of this thing called the Ring Cycle, and with his first ever pay packet, I believe, in his first full-time job, which I guess must have been the early 1960s, he bought the first ever LP recording of the Ring Cycle and was absolutely hooked on this. This thing had sort of, it was like a sort of shrine in our living room when I was growing up, the Schulte Ring Cycle in its big box. And my father would play it, so he'd take out the LPs and wipe them down lovingly and place one on the turntable every Sunday afternoon. It would just echo through the house. And I kind of grew up with this music, just kind of the background hum of Wagner, that rich, deep, intoxicating world, so big, so embracing, just absolutely filling and going on and on. And after that, I never really had the moment I got into pop music. I like it, I respect it, all my friends like it, I don't have any quarrel with it. To me, it always seemed a bit just like snacking, you know? Yeah. If you've grown up on Wagner, I mean, I love snacks, God knows, you can see that looking at me. You know, nothing like a delicious, exquisite little, you know, amuse-bouche or a burger or something. To me, but the full immersive experience, the sheer scale that classical music offers, of worlds, the sense of immersion. I mean, I got into that quite early, I think. And also, I mean, as Alexander says, I mean, the lighter side of it, there's nothing more sublime than going to a really terrific performance of a great comic opera, something that's funny, that's light, that's done with brilliant delicacy, wit, charm, verve, panache, humour, sometimes raucous humour. I'm a great lover of operetta, Gilbert and Sullivan, Offenbach, Lehár, Johann Strauss, all these people. I love seeing these things. Just, there's nothing like the sort of buzz you feel when these things are absolutely pinged. You've come out there, you just feel like you're walking on air. It's lighter than air, almost. And then, again, playing music. I was lucky. I had free cello lessons at school. Some places still offer that. It's under threat, of course, but it unlocks so much, absolutely unlocks so much. My parents were quietly delighted because they didn't play themselves. I think were thrilled to see me entering that world. It meant so much to them, and they kind of were very supportive. But playing in an orchestra, in a symphony orchestra, the feeling of immersion, the sense of being in that huge full sound, that sort of music on all sides, having almost physical presence, to feel the vibration in your chest when the double basses hits a low note sitting right behind you, that sense of being in diving, swimming through waves when you're in the middle of a Mahler or a Beethoven symphony. And also, later on, I learned to play string quartets as well. And that is an experience which I think that's about as high an experience, artistic experience, as civilization can offer you as a sort of participant, I think. It's just absolutely, I can't state how pleasurable it is. It's sort of imagine, you know how you're having a conversation or an argument and you realise after the event what the perfect thing to say, the most perfect, the most clever, the most elegant, the most winning rejoinder. It's as if all those perfect, elegant, winning rejoinders are scripted for you by a genius like Haydn or Mozart or Beethoven. And you're in a conversation with four people, you're all getting in your best lines. None of you is winning or getting one over the other. You're all sharing it equally, and at the same time, you're enjoying what they're saying, you're enjoying what you're doing. It's sort of the conversation is pinging each way, and you're immersed in this mental process of this genius who's been dead for centuries, and at the same time, you feel like you're absolutely yourself and part of something that's possibly shared. And there's nothing that matches that feeling, really, of if you can do it, if you have the chance to do it, sit down and playing a part in a great string quartet is just, I think, you know, that's something I'll always try and make time to do. And make, if, you know, if it's hard to pull together four people, especially amateurs these days, but if you can do it, it's so rewarding. It's just such, I mean, jazz, I imagine, offers a similar experience.
Yeah.
Probably being a pop group as well, but there's something about the absolute finesse, the absolute rightness, the sort of clarity, the wit, the craft, and the profundity as well. I mean, I remember playing, I think it's the first time I ever played Bruckner's string quintet. It has this slow movement. I'd never heard it before, but there I was making these notes happen to my cello. And as I was playing, I could you could almost feel the emotion swelling out of the music for the first time. And my hands started shaking. It was just so moving. Yeah. Moments like that. I say it's about the feelings at the end, isn't it? It's about the feelings.
Yeah,
it's like all music, like all art, it's about what you feel.
Completely agree. I mean, I'm also a cellist, and I love playing a string quartet at school, and I love that feeling. I also, reflecting back, remember with fondness the times where we didn't play so well, where it was a bit... You know, we kind of messed it up. But it's like being part of a... It's not that different to being part of a sports team where, of course, you celebrate when everything sinks. There's a kind of weird sixth sense of how you're all doing well that day. But sometimes it's funny that you're not quite on top of your game as well.
I used to say this about playing an orchestra. As amateur orchestra, I played in mostly. I played in a couple of professional ones. But imagine the most engrossing, satisfying team sport in the world, but one in which no one has to lose. Yeah. You know, no one comes out second. Everyone wins.
There is a fantastic sense of community in music making. I mean... singing in choirs. I mean, I sing with good amateur choirs, but there are more community-based choirs as well. But it really takes you out of yourself. The fact that for those 2 hours of the week, you're focused on the music and achieving something positive together. Yeah. And, you know, you can leave the rest of the world behind and all your worries. Yeah,
Pulling something off, I think, is very important.
Gives you a sense of purpose.
And especially when you're... I mean, I also think there's something that is, as you say, Richard, is about the feelings. And I also play the piano, but I'm always nervous playing the piano. I always got the inner critic on the shoulder telling me I'm not good enough. And part of the beauty of it when I'm, you know, when I play well or did play well in concerts was kind of showing the inner critic that they were wrong. Whereas with the cello, I never felt anxious when I played and I never felt self-conscious in concerts. And yet I don't have the same mental landscape with the cello. The piano feels much more personal, like I'm doing something that changed me in sorts of ways. Mm. So it's not always, I think this perception that classical music should be sort of relaxing or should be about unwinding tension or something. But actually, a lot of the joy is dealing with bad feelings and showing how you can stick with them.
And I mean, if you're singing, it's such a bodily thing. If you're not relaxed, if you're worried, if you're upset, your voice is the first thing to go.
It's a way of processing life in all its and of enriching life. And I mean, it addresses so many, just even day-to-day issues, really, the way you think about people, the way you interact with people, the way you think about ideas, the way you think about how emotions matter to you and what role they play. It's all there, I think. And, you know, that sort of useful physical skill as well, you know, that pleasure you get from just having physical mastery, from having done the practice, from having your fingers do what you want to do at a given time. I mean, that craft as well. I mean, craft is a very underrated thing in art. I mean, just simply the beauty of being able to do something supremely well because it's worth doing well is something I think I've always admired. And I admire incredibly when I go to the opera. I mean, I have to criticise these people for a living. But all the time, I'm just thinking, how on earth do they do that? You know, how on earth do they sing a three-hour opera by Thayer Musgrave, which no one has heard since 1980, in front of an audience of 2,000 like that, and just absolutely make it live? I'm just in awe of these people.
It's remarkable. And I think it's sort of accessible in a way. I mean, sports... I think what people love running, for example, because it's intrinsically just accessible. You can do it for free. You can go out front door and go and do it. But sport, if you want that kind of access to those flow states, I don't know. That I mean, there's probably a whole literature on how you get there in sport compared to how you get through mastering a musical instrument. I always felt that playing golf was not that different from me than singing. And I always thought about it in the same way, that the way I played golf and the way I'd approach singing a piece of music, I could tell whether it was going to go well or not. because it was the same kind of emotional state. And I wonder whether with classical music, people understand this stuff when they think about sports.
Like, it's well, I hope obvious, not, because you know, my associations with sport are entirely negative.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, basically, here, I'm afraid, yes. Running for a quite, train earlier, yeah, it hurts.
It's quite. I totally understand why people just hate sport and not don't care and stuff. Whereas people will accept the elite argument in something like sport. They yes. want their sports people to be elite and to be proud of being part of an elite.
And interestingly, that's often bound up with the national thing, isn't it? Yeah. It's our team, our national team, but that's...
How much is invested in getting gold medals at the Olympics or our national team? Think if half that was spent on our national music.
Of which most people are unaware that we have these great performers.
There is this double standard that... Yeah, the values that we prize in sport, that we prize in popular culture, that we prize in politics are suddenly problematic.
Yeah. I'm not sure we do prize elite in the context of politics. I'm not sure all our politicians are terribly impressive.
Well, no, but that's another another topic. But nonetheless, people strive to excel and people we expect to excel. We want our leaders to be impressive.
Yes.
We want big personalities, big charismatic, skillful, intelligent, highly proficient personalities, don't we? And, and classical music produces these in large numbers, and it's seen as problematic, isn't it, when they do that?
We did, of course, in living memory, have a prime minister who was a very good musician, Ted Heath.
Yeah, people in the classical music world do nothing but mock him, do they? It's always, look at Germany, where the politicians love music so much and go to the opera regularly. He says, well, we had a prime minister who literally conducted orchestras in his spare time, and you
amazing.
Laughed at him.
Yeah.
But then again, there's this
sectarian thing.
Tribal thing. You know, no one will accept that George Osborne and Michael Gove are massive Wagner fans and could regularly be seen at Covent Garden or Longer Opera, but they don't count.
But, politicians have hidden that sort of interest from... there's some people have done some interesting studies on Desert Island Discs and also Who's Who. And what politicians list has certainly changed.
I mean, that's the interesting thing. It would be seen as an electoral disadvantage in this country to be too into this posh elite art form, unfortunately. And they know that. They're canny. They hide it. They all pretend they prefer Ernie the Milkman from the West. I mean, was that David Cameron? I mean, he was patron of Bampton Classical Opera in Oxfordshire.
He kept that quiet. A
small company that specialises in reviving obscure late Baroque operas. And he was patron of that. And we didn't hear about that.
No,
we did hear if he liked the Benny Hill theme. This is politics.
Yeah.
We get the politicians we deserve, possibly.
Yeah. Well, I think that's quite a...
another question.
Yeah, quite a good note to end on, actually. But thanks so much for that discussion, Guy. I think we covered a huge amount of ground. And thanks for your personal reminiscence as well. I thought it was really beautiful and profound too. So... thanks for coming on, guys.
Oh, thanks for having us.
You've been listening to EI Talks, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones, and EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn. Till next time, thanks for listening.